Hello, I'm Joan. I'm a Canadian family physician who also works as a restorative medical educator, facilitator, and coach. I create spaces that rehumanize the work of healthcare. I'm creating this podcast to remind myself, as well as anyone else working in a helping profession, that when you are working and caring for your human patients, you are the other human in the room. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. I am super excited for this healthcare human conversation. I am a fresh but big fan over the internet of this particular guest. And I actually have the nurse practitioner who works with me. She's the one who said, Joan, you have to hopefully get this person on your podcast. She's like on Instagram talking about feelings, talking about physician burnout, and she loves Taylor Swift, and so you will love her. I like looked at your Instagram and was like immediately DM'd you because I just knew immediately like, yes, this is a yes person for me. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. Hi, listeners. I'm Dr. Jessie Gold. I am a psychiatrist. I am an associate professor of psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. I'm also the chief wellness officer for the University of Tennessee system. I primarily clinically see college students, faculty, staff, so healthcare workers. I'm based at the Health Science Center, which is, med students, pharmacy students, dentistry students, nursing students, and that's my clinical population. I just wrote a book that I'm sure we're going to talk about, but in my spare time, I suppose I enjoy writing and doing media advocacy around mental health, especially mental health in college students and especially mental health in healthcare workers.
Mm. I love all of that so much. I guess I always love hearing people's story as a way to begin. Like for you, so it's interesting, the population you serve is a population that either you used to be a part of in terms of being a college student and a medical student and resident, and now you still are a part of. So what's been your journey like going through those spaces, and what about that has drawn you to give that work back to other people?
Yeah, it's like the observational narcissistic path of clinical medicine or something. It's like I pay a lot of attention around all of the things I was experiencing and wanted it to be better, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So when I was in undergrad, I was pre-med, but I just hated it. And I always wanted to be a doctor. So it frustrated me that I hated it so much. And I felt like a lot of the people who were so good at it, like, and would have been great clinicians, were dropping out because of grades or stress or whatever else. And it wasn't really talked about when I was in college, like so much about like going to therapy or being on meds or things like that. But you could just tell that people were really like giving up stuff that they really liked. And I was watching that happen and at the same time just being frustrated myself because I could see myself giving it up because of that. And I majored in anthropology and found anthropology to sort of like balance me. And so I wasn't just with those people and in those classes, but at the same time was still struggling with all of that, like anybody kind of, I think, that dealt with those classes. And, you know, the first time I, you know, asked for mental health help, I was in college, like a junior. And when I went to ask for help, I told my story pretty guarded because I didn't really think that anyone deserved it. And, I was told by the counseling center basically that I was like not sick enough to get care there. Like that's my summary statement of it. And probably if you went back and listened, it wasn't exactly like that. But what I got out of it was that, you know, they had not a lot of spaces and I didn't qualify for one of them. And, you know, I didn't really like go into everything. So I kind of was like, okay, is this validating or invalidating? And I think it had some mix because I had postponed getting help for so long. And when I finally did, I was like, well, I finally got here, like, you know. And so I think that really inspired me to be a softer landing, better landing for that group. You know, so when I was in med school and starting to get drawn to people's stories in psychiatry, I said, oh, well, that was not a fun experience for me. Like, I could do that better for someone. I could not scare them away from getting help for the first time. And, you know, that just sort of continued through training for me. And then, you know, as I went along, I paid attention to the other groups that I was in. And that was med students and then residents and now, you know, faculty and staff. And I said, oh, look, more groups that aren't being paid attention to and, you know, are really struggling in pretty significant numbers, but people think that it's not a big deal or they minimize it or it comes into focus with something bad, but not all the time. And this is a weird way we train people and I don't know why we do it. And, you know, my master's in anthropology that I got at the same time as undergrad was on pre-med as a culture. And so I started to really look at, like, starting in undergrad, like with the people who are pre-health, like how we train the people that we train and why we train that way. And that really just kind of continued as a thread for me too. It's a convoluted way of saying that, you know, I have always been super observant and frustrated by systems and wanting to fix them at every space that I could to make it better for somebody else. Because if it wasn't great for me, you know, it could be better for other people or my friends or, you know, and so I think I had the awareness to start caring about those populations and sort of just like leaned into that clinically and leaned into that like research and like advocacy and administratively too.
Pre-med culture. That's like, I was like, that is a thing you can study. What did you like, whether it's from your research or even since then, obviously you've thought a lot about it. What do you find are some of the elements of that culture that are dominant, and in particular the ones that maybe could use a little shifting? I have an answer, but I want your answer.
Yeah. I mean, so when I started looking at it, there really wasn't a lot of research on it. There were a lot of research on like the like classes and why we took those classes and the impact of those classes on people, but there wasn't anything like too much on that actual group and for sure not their mental health. There's still not a lot on their mental health. There's some studies that look like we go to med school fine and equivalent to age match peers in med school makes us depressed. And I've always sort of struggled with that because I see pre-meds in my clinic and they don't seem great and I wasn't great. And so I'm like, something's missing in those measurements, and maybe it's not depression, maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's perfectionism, maybe it's something else. But I think that we definitely have traits that we are not great that get kind of preyed on by going to that path. So I would say most of us are overachievers in that setting. We're then kind of set up to be in competition with each other for lots of reasons, like one being a curve on a test, another being limited spots to get in, you know, and so we're overachieving and competitive. And so then you kind of like line people up that way, and that can come off pretty pathologic because people will not tell you things on tests or hide notes or whatever. I mean, I remember before a test asking a good friend, like afterwards, saying something like, did you know how to do this problem? And she was like, no. And then she got it right. So like, it was weird. Like I had asked her before kind of how to do something like that. And she acted like she didn't know how to do it. But anyways, it's a sidebar. But I think that just like, that was a good friend to me. I think she didn't even know it like brought that out of her. And so like hyper competitive, overachieving perfectionists, I think as a result, really not set up for failure and a lot of the sort of inevitability of it. There's a really good piece that was in the British Medical Journal sort of looking at what we have in common with elite athletes. And it was written kind of right around when Simone Biles first said she wouldn't compete. And it talks about this a lot and says like, because we're hyper competitive and also want to help people, you know, what we sort of get trapped to believe that like we somehow won't be affected by the work that we do, or we won't fail, or we won't make mistakes. And so like we are fall harder when we do because we're not prepared for it. And then we also don't see vulnerability as a strength because it's something someone else can beat us for. So if like we express that we're struggling or we express a need and that makes it so someone else could get a better grade or someone else could prey on that need, like that exposes us in a way that's dangerous to competition. And so we don't. And so I think it's a pretty – we start pretty early being set up in that way. And I think it doesn't make it so we can really care for each other very well, let alone care for ourselves.
Ugh, yes. It's interesting. I'm reflecting on my own journey, and there were things that were challenging about med school and residency too. And part of it might be like, I became a family physician for many reasons, but one might have been because I was like, can I opt out of this anything competitive as quickly as possible? But like, I feel like the biggest sort of myths about being competitive and like the dog eat dog Hunger Games-esque, like that was harshest in the pre-med program I was in, which is sort of tragic because, you know, once you're in med school, then it's like, phew, we've made it. And then there's a bit more collegiality. It probably depends on the med school for sure. There's something about that where like, yeah, not prioritizing relationship, not prioritizing staying human, staying connected, because that's not as important as beating each other, achieving. And is that the kind of mindset we want to be like prioritizing training, indoctrinating people into if eventually they're supposed to become physicians? And like, I mean, you're not competing against anyone when it's you and a patient. I hope not. But like, it's just not the mindset that's actually going to help you when you're with a patient.
No, but it does make you not want to admit if you like don't know. And it does make you like really freak out if you make an error or something. And it sets us up for really not good mental health spaces because all that stuff will happen because we can't possibly never have that happen. And just like sometimes I think I used to believe that like I could make it through work and do a million things and never be affected by it because like somebody who's good at this stuff could do our job nonstop, not sleep a lot and be fine. Like that's just fine. You don't need sleep. You don't need to take care of yourself. And I know I'm not the only person who thinks that. And so like it's when you do get affected by your job, it's like this, like, oh, wait, like turns out like I am a human and like I can't pretend that I'm not and just keep powering through and doing 1,000 things at one point. You know?
No. So would you say, it sounds like in some level you like, you know, you saw the ones and zeros of the matrix all the way along and that you're like, hey, why do I hate this? You know, you were already noticing that thing. And would you say there was a point when you're maybe further into your career or training where you realize, uh-oh, I have to actually apply this to myself? Was that – did you have a couple of those aha moments?
Yeah. I mean, I paid attention and knew it wasn't good and, like, knew that people needed to care about, like, our populations and that I hated the word high functioning and that, you know, there were just things, like, I could tell were bothering me. But that doesn't mean that I applied it to myself. I mean, I'd always – I mean, after college, I've been on medication since then, so it – was always a part of my sort of story to be thinking about my mental health. But, you know, a lot of times along the way, one I described pretty significantly in my book about having burnout, like I was taking care of healthcare workers in the pandemic as a psychiatrist and just sort of stopped paying attention to myself in the equation for lots of reasons, guilt being a primary one, just because I was like behind the screen and wasn't having to go in and had a lot of guilt about that. And so I was like, I can do this. I can help here. And so I did patients, I did outreach, I did education, like I did everything I could possibly do all the time and kind of was like, this is great. I'm great. I can do 100 things. And then sort of like quickly, you know, maybe not as quickly as I should have, like really burnt out. And was like sleeping every day after work and just was like very confused by that and didn't know where it came from and thought I was physically ill and, you know, all the things that all of us do. And so there, like, that's a prominent time where I had to sort of go, oh, wait, like, hello, silly, apply this to yourself kind of thing. But yeah, it's not the only time, and it won't be the only time, you know, because I think it's really easy to sort of fall back into a rhythm of like, my job is to take care of other people. I can take care of other people. And you just stop like turning the mirror or something. Like you stop like looking at yourself. Yeah. And so you stop noticing stuff and you stop noticing changes. And so when you do, it's much worse than it was before. So it's just like, you know, something I think all of us have to deal with all the time. But for yeah, sure, that time was like a prominent, like, wait a second.
Yeah. So for that time, because I'm imagining as well, and like, I feel it too sometimes, it's like, oh, well, now that I talk about like well-being and how to navigate burnout, like that means I should always be above it or something, because it's like, now it feels like it's an extra layer of shame I could apply to myself if I'm having a struggle moment. Let's just put it that way. So for you in that time of like, I'm offering mental health care to everyone else, I'm saying take care of yourself, and now I realized, oopsies, I did a very human thing, which was give in to the demand, which was outsized my capacity. How did you pull yourself back in that time? Because the demand didn't go away. I mean, the demand is higher than ever for people require. People are coming out of the woodwork finally saying that their mental health needs care. Now, how do you manage that?
I mean, I think some of it is like a restructuring of like how I think about it, you know? So a lot of stuff that needs to change is systems, and the systems aren't going to change tomorrow. And so if you want to stay in your job, you have to figure out how you can fit within what you're doing and what feels right to you. You can quit too. That's totally an option. We don't talk about that enough. But, you know, I think for me, first I had to sort of like actually take some time off. I didn't take a ton, but I had to actually go on vacation and reset. Not, you know, completely, but reset to the point where I wasn't so burnt out. And then I think when you reset, you can't just go back to it exactly the same. So you have to start actively paying attention to yourself. I have to start actively asking myself how I'm doing. I have to actively say no to things on purpose. I have to actively pay attention to my capacity for things. I have to actively notice early warning signs. Like for me, anger is a big one, and not just blow past it and be like, I guess I'm having a bad day, but say like, oh, like something's off, and like, let's figure out what that is. It's a lot more of like an active participation in my life, I suppose. That's like a way of putting it. I think I have a mindset that's a lot more realistic too. So I actually think I will burn out, you know, and I think I will do it multiple times. And that's because I have a job that travels. I have another job that's writing. All of those things are busy and take a lot out of me. And sometimes I can't balance it all. And that's okay. Yeah. And sometimes something's got to give. And sometimes that thing is me. And hopefully it's not always me and that I'm paying more attention to it. But I think I have a really realistic sort of perception now that like it's not realistic to do as much as I do and think it's not going to affect me. It's realistic to say you're doing a lot. maybe you will need some time to recover in this and you should plan that out. And maybe it might affect you and you should plan that out. And that's okay. And it's not a failure. It's life. And it's just bound to happen when you're doing so much. And so it's sort of like, I don't know. I feel like sometimes I say the quiet things out loud more. Like I everybody might know that's true. Like logically it is true that having a lot of patience and doing a lot of work could make you exhausted at some point. But I actually try to like name it and plan for it and leave time for it and say no to things because of it. And I think that has been a major shift for me. It doesn't mean it's not something I work on. I always have to sort of reset around it and find other skills that I don't hate to do. And like, you know, I still see my therapist every week. So, you know, and she's going on maternity leave and it makes me mad, you know, like I still like, despite she's the fact human, that like, yeah. Okay, I get it. She's also human and, you know, but it's, I'm so used to it as like my time. So it does, it is still very much a part of like work for me. I have to still work at it, but I think I sort of more mindfully work at it now.
Yeah. Cause you could get kind of perfectionistic about never wanting to burn out and then, well, now you're in a paradox of some kind or another.
Yeah. Like that's what I mean. Like, I think we apply it to like, somehow I can just do all of this and be fine. Like a very good employee, a very good doctor, a very good mom, whatever you want to use, like should, which is a bad word, should be able to do that, right? Like I should be able to do this. And if you can't, something's wrong with me. And instead, it's actually just, duh, of course you can't, you know? And I sort of think that that mindset has helped me, even though that still means I burn out sometimes. It's just like, I'm not so mad at myself for it. Like I'm not mad at myself for needing time. I'm not mad at myself for taking weekends sometimes to sleep. It's just life. Like sometimes you have to do that. And would I wish that I had all of the energy in the world? Yeah, sure. Cool. But I don't know anybody who does.
We've all got like some amount of a limit, right? Like that's just the reality of being a human. I would love to hear more, both your own experience, but also if you use this a lot in your work with patients about like getting to know your emotions, speaking of like, how do you feel and emotions? So for you, you've noticed like, oh, anger's not a problem. Anger's trying to tell me something. How often do you talk about feelings when you're a psychiatrist? Probably not.
I am a feelings doctor. That is true.
Yes. So, well, I would just love to hear – how about this? I would love to hear how you talk about emotions, especially to someone who, despite the fact that we get all the training on the body, which it includes the nervous system, which includes emotions, but like we've sort of been indoctrinated to think that emotions aren't allowed in medicine. And how would you like begin to, maybe this is your whole book, but like, how would you begin to like broach that topic of how acknowledging the fact that we have emotions is useful to being a clinician?
I wouldn't say it's the whole book, but it's a large chunk. And there's a character in the book who's an ER doctor who doesn't have feelings, like is very numb and, you know, sort of realizes that she got there initially. She realizes she got there because she had like, over-applied stoicism, I guess you could say. Like she was told, like, remove yourself from this situation. Don't have feelings. Like, you know, good doctors are stoic. Like watching people around you, like go to a code and then go to lunch. Like you just sort of absorb that like you're not supposed to have a reaction. You're not supposed to have feelings. And then, you know, we give like good subjective evaluations to people who don't. And so you see that too. And a lot of the messages you get are like emotions get in the way, emotions distract, emotions make it about you. It's not about you. It's about them, right? And so you just don't pay attention to them. And it doesn't mean that I would say in every instance at work that I would assume that you're going to be like, I'm feeling angry now, or I'm going to cry now. Like, because sometimes in our jobs, we still need that defense. Like, we still need to be able to just go through the motions of some of our job. But you do need this space sometime. Like, you can't just push it down and never feel it, because it also starts to bleed into your personal life, and it also starts to bleed into like other scenarios, right? And so, or like a sort of like a beach ball that you push down and smacks you in the face eventually, right? Because like you can't contain that for that long. And so you have to make like times at some point in the day or after a work day or before a work day to have transitions around feelings, where you actually don't just go like, I'm a vessel doing this work. You go, what was my day like? How was my sleep? How am I feeling? And actually doing that is important. I think, you know, we will say things like okay and fine all the time, but those aren't actually feelings. So, you know, trying to force like real words, even if they're sort of like simple, like mad, sad, right? That helps, because you're actually calling it something. You know, there's a feelings wheel with lots more complex words if you want bigger words to use, but, you know, simple ones are okay too. And I think naming it gives it a place, allows it to be. The big other thing is not to try to correct it right away. So like, we also try to go, I am sad, fix sad, you know, how do I stop being sad? And so we might know coping skills or something because we learned some, and we might jump right into that and be like, okay, sad. When I'm sad, I need to go for a run. When I'm sad, you know, and I try to encourage like hanging out for a second. So naming it is a whole process that takes some time. Giving space to name it is a whole process that takes some time. And then not immediately correcting it is a thing that takes some time. So a lot of that stuff is like unlearning, not just medicine, but like the culture you came from, your gender, society, you know, work it through. All of us have emotions, have meaning everywhere. And so you're unlearning a lot. And so it's not something that will happen like overnight. Like, you can't just be like, now I shall feel feelings. Like, you've pushed them down for a while. And so like, to start doing that is work. And like, that it's a lot of my own personal psychotherapeutic work too, because I have my own concepts of feelings despite being a feelings doctor. And, you know, having to learn that is hard.
What has been the most helpful, like, newer concepts of feelings that feel like they allow feelings in more, that have helped you personally?
Yeah. So simply like literally asking, like having a transition after work or before work has been big for me, because I would just like go and not take a break. And so sometimes even between sessions and stuff, like I'll make sure I get up and go pee and like just take a second and not just be like, okay, meeting, because it's really easy to do that. I think, you know, for me, like asking myself what it is, like why I'm feeling that way sometimes is helpful. So like, I'll be like, I'm angry. Okay, let's just be angry. But what provoked the anger? And like, why am I so angry? And sometimes there's like reasons, and like, it's telling you something. And if you let it be without correcting it immediately, sometimes that helps. With that. Yeah. So for me, like anger, usually I get angry when like something is inauthentic or unjust, but also when somebody's asking me for stuff and I don't have capacity, but I don't really want to say no, but I wish that they would know that I can't do it. You know, like it's don't like my, ask. Like I wish they could read my mind and know that I can't. But I'm mad because I have to say no, or I'm mad because I'm mad being asked things. Emails make me mad a lot of time. Like a lot of our work these days is email, and it's an early warning sign for me if I can't look at my emails, because it's like causing too much distress. And the distress is usually because of being asked stuff and just being kind of like, I can't deal with this right now. Like I can't. other things that have worked, like I tend to remember the bad stuff of the day. So trying to be a bit more mindful of like what good stuff happened. And, you know, there's a whole thing called three good things where you just like try to remember the like three good things that happened that day. I'm not very good at always doing it. Sometimes I need like a rose and a thorn or something, but yeah. I do try to give myself like it wasn't all bad, because it's very easy to be like, ugh, today. Instead of going like, well, like, you know, it didn't start off so bad. Like you had that meeting and that person was really nice and you had a good conversation. It's just that like for a couple hours you didn't like what you were doing or the meeting or something pushed you over. And so like I try to fight the evolutionarily like designed like, oh, bad, bad, bad that comes. And so those things have helped me. I try also my like not to judge, as I say, bad, not to judge feelings as good or bad. You'll catch yourself doing that a lot around anger, sadness, big feelings. But I try to, when I hear myself say, oh, like that was bad or something, I can actually hear my therapist say, I'm not putting judgment on that, or like, let's not put judgment on that. And so I can kind of like backtrack myself some, but I don't always hear it. Like the reason I hear her voice is because I've probably done that so many times where it's like, well, I didn't say that judgment word, or, you know, I didn't say bad. I did.
It's so ingrained, right? Of course. Yes. You don't even know you're doing it because it's just like breathing at some point because of how much it's been in us, right? I'd love to hear, moving from the internal emotion level to actually the opposite. So you are one of these, you hold a position that I've heard more of in the past, kind of since the pandemic. I'm sure they existed before, but I've heard these positions coming up more, which is chief wellness officer.
Yeah.
And I'm always so curious how those positions, how folks in those positions are doing. And I'm sure it varies wildly depending on the person and the system they're a part of. So how's it going for you? In a way that won't get you in trouble or whatever, but, and also like, what have been some like experiments or explorations in shifting the system as much as that's allowed as part of your job, but like how's that going for you?
Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting. So I have been a person who has been interested in this population for pre-pandemic for sure. For most of my career, as we kind of talked about, and you know, these jobs had sort of been popping up and I was not necessarily like, oh my gosh, that's what I want to do. But I, you know, over the pandemic was doing so much outreach and education and administrative stuff around like our own well-being that I was like, I guess that's going to become my natural path, or like I've stumbled into this being my path. And so, you know, my current job, I started in February. It's a different job than probably a lot of people think of for chief wellness officers. So I'm over all five schools in the University of Tennessee system, which is a big land mass and also big a number of students, so almost like 59,000 students. But what's interesting is the five campuses include undergrad and grad for five campuses. So I'm not exclusively hospital based. And so a lot of people who have roles like mine, they were born out of working for a hospital system. And I think they probably make a lot more money than me, but they're probably dealing with very different stuff in terms of sort of trying to get things done. You know, I'm in higher ed. And I think there's a lot of interest in what I'm doing here. When I was hired, I pretty clearly said, like, I don't want to be a scapegoat, and I don't want to be expected to fix everything tomorrow. And so I went in with that as the conversation, and they've really respected that. You know, I've been here for 6 months. I've spent it really talking to people, having meetings, understanding what's going on, spending the time to really build relationships, because anything that I do, I need buy-in for, and I wouldn't have buy-in if I just came in and magically did it, you know? And so I've had a lot of support in that way, which is gonna, I think, set me up more for success. You know, it's a big scope. I just told you how big it is. And I think that that's the hardest part of the job, is like trying to satisfy a lot of people who have ideas of what I could be doing with what I think I could be doing. But really, I'm not at a place where I could say what I should be doing yet, because we have to do a lot of like less sexy background work. So like getting all the data on one like page so you could compare, getting all the programming on one page so you can compare, right? Like right now it's just everywhere in all these silos, and my job is to break them. But to break them, I need to kind of understand like the landscape. And so a lot of my job for the next year with the help of grad students is going to be like defining the current state in a much more systematic, evidence-based way. And because I have a supportive job that doesn't assume I can fix things without knowing what to fix, I feel set up to be successful with that. I don't know that everybody could do that, because I think a lot of people come in with being born out of a crisis and needing to stand something up pretty quickly to be like, look, I'm doing stuff. See, can't you see? I'm doing stuff. Yay. And I don't function well like that. I think that we've probably made a lot of dumb mistakes like that, just kind of reinventing the wheel like that, or choosing something that's not really helpful for your school and your population. And so I think these jobs can be pretty challenging for a lot of reasons, like expectations and scope and just sort of like culture around change. But I've felt – as it stands, I feel supported in sort of my slow method of like really trying to figure this out. And, you know, maybe at some point somebody's going to be like, what is that chick doing? And like, can she like move it along? And
where are the results?
Yeah, like bring on some results, chick, that we're paying, right? But, you know, right now in this moment where I stand and supported by my bosses and stuff, like I think they get that. That's how I want to do it. And I think that they appreciate it. It might mean that we have to explain it some. Like, it might mean that I have had to make presentations in which I tell people that I'm taking my time and why. But I think people get it, you know? Yeah. Like, I think people don't want to be told this is the only way to do something, says an outsider who knows nothing about the culture of our school. And I know that having five schools with five different cultures, none of them want to be told that like this is now the culture for all of us and like this is what we all need to be doing, because they're very different. There's a tiny rural school, there's a SEC school with big sports, big frats and sororities, then there's a health science center campus, which is where I'm based, right? Like they're very different. And if I approached it like, here's what the literature says, the end, I don't think it would be right. And so I like the challenge, but I will say mentors and stuff were like, oh God, what are you getting yourself into? Like, you know, they're like, that's such a large scope and it's pretty ill-defined, and they don't necessarily have like success measures for you, and they don't necessarily have a budget for you. You know, like I'm kind of making it up as I go, but I don't know. So far, I have felt supported in that, despite, you know, like my mentors like kind of being like, ooh, like, can you get some of that on paper, you know? But I think it's my brain fits well with like fixing big problems and thinking through them. I just like that. I'm an ideas person, but I do need sometimes for people to like bring me down to earth. But I think I have enough people around me that are doing that.
Yeah. Well, I'll say, like, speaking of a big idea that's like, I don't know how you would begin to measure it. And I mean, there's a, like, how does one measure? But like literally by how you're approaching this job, you're embodying what wellness looks like in the, like you literally just described it with emotions, where you have to take time to observe and not immediately try to fix. Like you literally are doing the thing that you're learning yourself and teaching people to do that will make them well. And you're embodying it in how you're approaching your job. Like to me, that's my personal belief as always, like when your outsides are matching your insides, like that's going to have an impact whether people know it or not. Like already in the meetings you're a part of, by speaking that way, by not instead embodying the culture that's got us here, you're embodying a new culture by being slow, by taking your time. You're already changing it, even though you're not like having the webinars that they think will be the ways that they will learn how to be well or whatever we think, you know? I just love that. That's so cool.
Oh, thank you. I hope people realize that and don't just go, hey, what's that chick doing?
Probably both. But yeah, even the people who are like, what's that chick doing? There's a part of them. That's my belief. There's some part of them. Even if they're like, oh, but like, if we could have fast solutions in wellness spaces, like the part that I really relate to, like for a while I was doing like EDI type work, and it's sort of, I can imagine there's commonality. First of all, there is commonality between EDI and wellness for sure. But, and like beyond that, like if it would be good if you didn't have to exist, because it would be good if the dominant culture already had embedded in it how to help people be well. But that's not where we're at, right? So like, there's always going to feel like an urgent need for it. And yet it's going to take the time it takes to get there. And it's going to feel hard along the way. Like I just think that's really cool what you're doing.
Thank you. It's very kind.
I'd love to hear about your book.
Yeah.
First of all, how one goes about deciding to write a book, and what made you write this book? Why does this book mean so much to you that you birthed it and are offering it to the world?
I mean, I kind of told you that I have an observation problem. Mm-hmm. And I think in that same vein, I observe that the stories, you know, that we're telling about our own well-being are not out there enough, that we're not talking about our experiences, that people aren't feeling seen by the stuff that they're hearing and seeing, and that there's no like one place that all of this stuff is like thrown up together. You know, having nothing to refer my patients to that were struggling in the pandemic beyond like a memoir or something of somebody else, or you know, this like one story kind of thing, that became an obvious issue for me, was like that people in our jobs struggle and don't see themselves in any of the information, and maybe they don't want to read a paper because all they do is read papers, and like how can we give them some of the information in a tangible way, but at the same time how can people better understand what we're going through. Is I think that I watched like people care more in the pandemic about us. Because they didn't have a choice, but I feel like it's kind of chilled out now. And, you know, people mostly are like, well, why did that person act this way towards me? Or why did they not want to talk about my emotions or anything like that? And so I think we're very misunderstood. It's probably some kind of privileged thing to say that, but I do think we're like a misunderstood bunch, and we don't necessarily understand ourselves, so why should someone else understand us? Yep. But, you know, I had never aspired to write a book. I've always been a short writer, like 1,000, 1,500 words, in part to process, in part because I noticed gaps in what my patients were asking and what was available to give them. And a friend sort of said, like, but you could tell this story, and like, you should tell the story. I like the way that you frame these things, and I really think people should read it from you, and that you'll be mad if someone else writes it first. And she wasn't wrong. She also appealed to my competitive nature. You know, it's taken me probably 3.5 years to get to this point. I think I started like pitching agents in January 2021. Which is like, with pandemic time, 100 years.
Yeah, that was a century ago.
And, you know, it's really bizarre that it's about to actually be in the world, but it's called How Do You Feel? The subtitle is One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine. I think we've been talking a lot about the humanity part and the feelings part. It follows me and four of my patients forward through the first 6 months of the pandemic, but the pandemic is just a backdrop for our stressors to come out. It's not a pandemic book. And it really looks at all the barriers and challenges to caring for ourselves when we care for other people. So for healthcare workers, for sure, but for other people who care for people too, I would hope that anybody reading it would feel that way, that something resonated despite what they do for a living. But I would hope that, you know, the population that I've seen in my job will particularly see themselves in the stories.
How does it feel? Like it's a month away, right? From when we're recording it, but we're going to release it, I think, actually like the week it comes out.
But yeah.
For you, it's like a little less than a month, right?
Yeah. Weird. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think that I have a lot of anxiety that's grounded in vulnerability. I'm pretty open about stuff, but I would say this is the most open I've ever been. And it's all open in like a long form thing for the world to digest, right? Like it's so – I felt like this a little when I wrote a piece on being on meds and kind of that got to go out there and people could react. I feel like some of that, which is – a little anxiety about being vulnerable and like also people liking it.
Yeah. How do you, what are your methods you find helpful, put it that way, to putting out your humanity towards others? Because I mean, in some ways, this entire podcast is my project doing that. So it's a, I'm asking for personal advice. Because I've like cried on this podcast anyway, but beyond
I'm glad. I guess I'm well. You're welcome. I didn't do that to you today. I don't know. I think that it's important to be human, but I think that like you do have to protect it sometimes. You know.
Yeah.
So, I have to check myself when I'm constantly like asking other people how they are and not ask and not having a reciprocated relationship. I have to check myself when I like, you know, with this, I'm mentally prepared to sort of be out in the world with it. And I can't prepare for how I will actually feel.
That's the truth, isn't it?
And that's okay, I think.
Yeah.
When I was joking about my therapist maternity leave, the biggest reason that I'm angry is it's like literally the same time that the book comes out. Oh, but, dear. You know, that's just a joke. Like she has a life on her own scale. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the reason that I feel like that is because it's really unknown for me. And I wish you could predict emotions and feelings and stuff, but you can't. So just like I can't predict whether people will buy it. I'd like you to. That's why I talk about it. And
yes,
that's what, you know. But, you know, I think I can't control that. And there's a lot of sort of serenity, prairiness in that. And I'm okay with that. But I just have to let myself deal with however I do feel as it gets closer and as people read it and give me feedback and all that.
Yeah. You know, who would be like a great mentor that you can draw inspiration from is Taylor Allison Swift. Because she's put herself out there and has shared many an uncomfortable feeling through a song. And a couple people have opinions about her. So this is my beautiful segue that I just came up with because I know you are
job.
A fan. Thank you.
I saw what you did there.
But also, I actually do look to her. You know, if I'm like, I'm scared about putting out this podcast about my like traumatic resident experience. And then I'm like, look at Taylor, look at her doing it. And everyone cares what she thinks. So tell, we're going to spend a little time talking about Taylor Swift. So tell me your journey. You're like a long time Swiftie, yeah?
Long time Swiftie. I saw her open for Keith Urban when I was in college. And I've seen her every concert tour since. I wish I could count and tell you how many that is. I don't think it's every album, so I probably would be wrong. And then I've seen her a couple times for the Eras Tour. But I've been around the block for a while. It was definitely not cool for a long time. And so I had like a concert shirt from probably like forever ago that definitely would fit like half of me now. But I didn't keep it because like I didn't like it. It didn't fit. And it wasn't cool. So yeah. I didn't think that like I would ever want it again. And sometimes I'm like, oh gosh, I feel like that's like a vintage shirt for a Swiftie at this point to have
you
like.
You could like sell it on eBay or whatever.
Yeah. And you know, like maybe people were like, oh my gosh, that's a real shirt from that concert tour, you know, but I didn't keep it because it wasn't cool. And it's real cool now, which is super funny.
Yep. So what do you love so much about her?
I feel like she has a big catalog, which is nice because I think that if you have an artist and they just have one album, then you just have to like what you like on that album. There are definitely songs I don't like that she does, but it gives you like so many kinds of music. It's like listening to like 17 artists at once, which is nice. Like sometimes she's folk and like sometimes she's country and sometimes she's pop and sometimes she's kind of rock. And like that's nice. I think her lyrics are good. Anybody who says differently doesn't understand her. Yeah. But I think, you know, for the most part, intended to evoke some sort of emotion or describe some sort of scenario with emotion. And she does a very good job of it. And so they're definitely songs for different times in my life and things I've gone through in my life. And I've grown up with her in a lot of ways too. So I think that makes a difference. But there's not many artists that write good albums, like full albums. And she's pretty good. Like they're like, I'm not a person who will tell you there are no skips, but it's definitely one of the few things where I'm like, I'm going to get the whole album. I'm going to listen to it start to finish. And then I'm going to decide like in a couple times, you know? And so that's rare.
Mm, so true. Do you have like an era or what, like what's your current favorite era? It's okay if it's multiple.
Yeah. Like I'm a probably 1989 is the one of the, if not the best album, but just like in its entirety. But there's like songs along the way, you know, like I feel like people diss Tortured Poets, but there are a lot of good songs on Tortured Poets. It's just like
who's dissing it? Get those people off me.
I don't know. I think some of them don't get her writing. I think some of them don't understand why she just gave so – they were like, it's not coherent and da-da-da. Like, whatever. She just lets out the album she wants to let out. And so for me, I liked enough of it. It also performs really well in Eras. So that's cool. But – I like a lot of the angry songs. I like a lot of like Mad Woman or The Man. Like I like her little sort of like trend towards revenge and angriness usually. That's a good thread.
So did you just love Who's Afraid of Little Old Me?
Yeah, that was my favorite song on that album immediately. Then I like I Can Do It With a Broken Heart on that too. But that's predictably psychiatric.
He's like, yeah, that's hilarious. And yeah, it makes sense.
But I cry a lot, but I am so productive. Yes. But also like she says, like she's depressed and nobody even knows, right?
Yes. Oh my gosh. And she just acts like it's her birthday, but she's down bad crying at the gym on the inside. So like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like, how much of a, like, sort of phenomenon she's become just because, like, I used to, like, speaking of merch, like, now if I wear, like, a shirt to the airport or something, like, somebody says, like, oh, what, where'd you go? Which concert? Or something. And I'm like, it's cute and nice and bonding and stuff, but it's super weird. And I would never, I never would have had that happen before.
Yeah, it's just that's such a cultural obsession. I got caught in the wave. Like I liked 1989 when it first came out. I listened to that. That was my first one where I listened start to finish. I would listen to it all the time while driving.
It's good for driving. A good driving CD.
Although also she's, I mean, well, Harry Styles is crashing all over the place, but it was a snowmobile, so it's fine. But you know, there's a lot of like car crash metaphors in that. But then otherwise I haven't been like really dialed in. And so I just got caught in the wave of all the people who love her. And now I'm obsessed with her too. So,
well, the concerts are fun.
I'm going in Toronto. That's
the only time. Are you in the last group or is it Vancouver?
Vancouver's last, but I'm on the last night of the Toronto. So
something will happen in Canada. Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. I mean, it's like a really positive atmosphere. Yeah. And that's really nice. And like, I don't love, like, I don't have little kids, but like, it's fun to trade friendship bracelets with like really excited children. They don't always want to trade. They often want to just keep the one that they wanted, but it's a really like joyous atmosphere, which I don't know. I think in a setting where we sort of lacked a lot of community, it's nice. And I can understand why people have gone a lot and stuff like that.
Ugh. That's giving me some excitement. So thank you. Thank you for sharing. Well, we're at the end of our time. So if there are those that are listening that want to follow you as well as definitely purchase your book, where can they find you to do those things?
So I'm at Dr. Jessie Gold on like all of the things like, you know, J-E-S-S-I is how I spell it. Instagram, TikTok, the artist formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, you can probably find me that way too. Book-wise, like I know there's a Simon Schuster Canada website that like you could look up the title, which is How Do You Feel? And then Jessie Gold. But you also, I think, can get it from most of your booksellers. And then same within the US, like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores. It'll be all over the place on 10/8, but pre-orders really, really help me. They tell people that these topics matter, that they care about these topics, that you're excited by them. And hopefully, like, you know, they'll get more people who will want to write about these kind of things.
And maybe on some bestseller lists. That's always kind of fun.
I would love that. I sort of just like – I'm not a manifester, so if you are, feel free to manifest for me, but I sort of am realistic. And so if it happens, it happens. It would be great for the topic and it meaning that people are feeling seen and heard by it, but it is what it is.
It is what it is. I'm excited for you. I hope you get to the top. It doesn't actually matter. Achievement is stupid. We're trying to break all of these ideas anyway.
But you're just like impact. Achievement and competition is stupid, but serious.
You're on the top of the list. It's a process to decondition these things, okay? What can we do? Well, it was so lovely to meet you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
The last thing I usually say is I'm inviting you to think about, so the people listening are folks in healthcare typically, not all physicians, and they're trying to find their humanity inside of their work. And is there any words of encouragement you'd like to offer to them?
I think it's important that you go with the flow and like follow the things that you're passionate about. I know that's like a weird thing to say, but for me, I've never been like a 10-year plan person. I've been like these are the things I care about and I'll get to the things that like are successes and wins in those things if I just stick with the things I care about. I care about stories. I care about our healthcare. I care about college students. And I, you know, I can get there in the way that feels right to me and authentic to me. And so I would say like follow the path that like is most organic to you and your mission and like the things you care about, and it'll lead to good stuff.
That's beautiful. I needed to hear that. Yes, I co-sign that so much. 10-year plans are like cute little fantasies we make.
Like, yeah, I'm not. That's why I said I'm not like a manifester, right? Like I'm like, this book kind of came up. These things like come up. My job came up. Like, if you would have asked me pre-pandemic, I was probably going to tell you I would be much more focused on college mental health. And then a lot of this happened and that interest came forward. And you just sort of like step into the things that you care about and it'll the universe will respond.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you so much. And for everyone listening, definitely follow what you're passionate about and ask yourself how you feel. I love the idea. My invitation for you to think about before next week's podcast is, what's your transition plan at the end of the day? Do you have that moment to check in with yourself and be with your feelings and not try and fix them immediately? I think that's a beautiful little takeaway that we could be experimenting with this week. So that's my invitation to all of you. And otherwise, I'll talk to you next week. I would love to take this work deeper with you. Visit joanchanmd.com today and discover my growing menu of options for restorative medical education to suit your learning needs. I offer one-on-one coaching, customized workshops, and self-study courses that allow you to connect not only with my work on a deeper level, but also with other healthcare humans just like you. So if you want to start humanizing your work and healthcare to a deeper level and do it in community with others, please visit joanchanmd.com and find those options and what fits you and your life today.